The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week, I talked to the writer Ayub Khan Din about his long-awaited sequel to one of Britain's best-loved films, East is East. We speak to Lucy Walker as she prepares to walk the red carpet at the Oscars for her nominated documentary Wasteland about the rubbish pickers of Rio de Janeiro. Zan Brooks will be here as we review some of the week's other releases, including Anthony Hopkins in The Right, Aussie crime drama Animal Kingdom, and Oscar host James Franco starring as Allen Ginsberg in Howl. It's pure poetry, it's Film Weekly. West is West is the follow-up to the word-of-mouth hit East is East, written by Ayub Khan Din and depicting the culture clash within the British-Pakistani Khan family. 12 years on from the success of the original film comes the next part in the story. We catch up with the youngest child, Sajid, played by newcomer Akib Khan, as he's packed off by his dad, played by Om Puri again, to rural Pakistan to immerse himself in his old family values.
Your daddy is my chacha, uncle. My mummy, your daddy's sister.
I'm your first cousin, but I am married to your sister, Rehana.
Who?
Oh, your dad's other daughter, isn't it? From his proper marriage, you know, his first wife. He related to us also as well.
My daddy, his cha-cha, uncle.
Yeah, yeah.
My grandmother's sister was married to your grandfather's cousin.
Got it?
So I'm thrilled to welcome Ayub Khan Din onto Film Weekly. Welcome. Congratulations on your new work.
Thank you very much.
An updating of an old work. Was it strange to revisit, or was it always something you knew you were going to do, that there was more story to tell?
No, there was always a second story there. It was East is East was autobiographical, so the second part was going to be autobiographical as well. So it wasn't as if they could bring in another writer and make it up. And also, I've got really loyal actors as well, who I don't think would have worked on any other film written by someone else. But no, West is West existed as a script I'd written in back in the 90s called Riff It Was Here, about my experiences of going back to Pakistan being sent back to Pakistan as a 12-year-old and the problems I kind of faced there. So it always existed as that script. It's just that, one, I didn't want to jump into doing a sequel after East is East straight away, because everyone wanted East is East 2. I mean, really, East is East 2 is kind of same kind of problem, same kind of humour.
And they wanted it in Bradford still. They wanted the same family.
They wanted it set in Salford.
Just more of the same stuff.
And you know, every sequel I've ever seen has always been a disappointment, because they do try and redo the original film.
Yeah.
And that's not what I wanted. I wanted to take it away as far away from East East as I possibly could do. Yeah.
Is there a reason that there is a sort of a gap? How many years is it? It's 10 years, isn't it?
It's about 10 years. I think everyone was really kind of fed up of each other after East is East. But then Leslie was kind of saying, well, you know, why don't we do it? Why don't we do it? We must do it. And in 2007, it was a perfect opportunity, because I had a play on at the National, and then I was going off to live in Spain. I thought, this is a great project to go off and do, so I started it in 2007.
And the memories of your visit as a 12-year-old, were they obviously still kind of fresh in your mind, the colours? What was it that remained about that?
Well, it was just the stark contrast of leaving Salford in 1974 with running water and electricity, and Manchester United played around the corner on a Saturday. We used to mine the cars, and then suddenly the doors opened of this plane, and I was in a completely different world. And we see the journey from the airport. It was the journey that I took.
Yeah.
I came out of the airport, and all these men were just kind of hugging me and greeting me and saying, you know, I'm your cousin, I was like, I didn't have a clue who they were.
Yeah, they're wonderful scenes in the film.
And there was, you know, there was a beggar woman standing there with her hands up, and I thought she was another relative, and I just shook her hand. I mean, that's in the film, that's true. And then this kind of, this journey that they take was a journey that I took, which was this descent into a completely different century, when I was going down the roads, and suddenly there was a massive camel train of 100 camels, and there was a road crash on the side of the road, but there's people and dead bodies, but there was no emergency services.
I mean, he's dead Pakistani and everything, Armin is. You can't fault him on that.
It's difficult.
And he's not that ugly.
People worried.
What about?
They think he will be like his father. That maybe he will leave his wife here and marry English woman, like your father did.
My name won't do that.
Tanveer and Rihanna tell people this will happen. They don't want you or money to live here.
All of them live here.
They say your father will give all the lands to his son, and his daughter's nothing.
Is that what all this is about? Who gets left what?
They say you're not Pakistani, only half. And this is bad.
Bad for me, all right. I keep getting my head kicked in for it in England.
What's interesting is that the character in the film dealing with this as a 12-year-old boy is both wide-eyed, amazed by it, horrified by it. There are sort of 100 conflicting feelings that he has towards, almost as many conflicting feelings as there are in Pakistan itself. He's the outward reflection of what he's feeling inside.
It is a completely alien environment to him. So he does have all these different feelings. And also he's carrying over there a lot of baggage. He doesn't really want to be there. He's been made to go there. And so initially he's really unreceptive to anybody. He's as obnoxious there as he is as he was when he was in England.
Did you go with your father?
No, I was sent on my own. Right. I mean, I was passed on to someone at Birmingham Airport who passed me on to someone at Heathrow. And then when I arrived in Pakistan, there was a customs officer holding my picture at the bottom of the stairs, and it's just kind of got me by the shoulder and took me through.
You mentioned the father's journey as is something that you put on to yours. I mean, I suppose now you as an older man writing that as a father yourself, there's a lot more George in this as well as the kid.
Yeah, you know, George goes on a really kind of difficult emotional journey because you know, he goes back there and it's the first time he's seen his first wife in 30 years. And yes, there's always been contact there and he's sent money back and there's been letters and photographs exchanged. But he hasn't been really, he's never really been a part of her life in all that time. So he goes back thinking, you know, he's the King of England returned and Mr. Bountiful, and he's handing out his presents. And the wife is, at first, she's being the dutiful, subservient wife, but there's something really building in there. And that was the other thing about doing West is West. So many questions were asked about the first wife after East is East that I really wanted to address that. I really wanted to create this woman and show what she'd gone through and what her children had gone through and the way she actually confronts her husband. I thought that was a really important kind
of
issue.
This is a familiar picture. This is a story that's replicated, you know, many, many times, many fold across Pakistan.
There was a time in the 50s when immigrants from the subcontinent did have English girlfriends and in some cases married them with wives back in Pakistan. But I don't think it was a common occurrence, especially not with the way it was in our family, that we all knew that he had a first wife and two daughters, and we knew that that contact was there because nephews and nieces would be coming over. Mm. So it wasn't a kind of unusual thing. It was accepted as completely normal.
So this was is this the story of your father as well then?
Yeah, it is.
Absolutely.
It is, yeah.
As much as you can for the handiness of fiction. Yeah. East is East was a rambunctious comedy in many ways. The poster had a big dog on it, which I think was slightly misleading at the time.
It's all about marketing.
Did all right in the end, didn't it? Actually, I haven't seen this second one, West is West. I've only just noticed that the new poster for that's come out, which again is looking a bit kind of, you know, higgledy-piggledy letters. It's actually a much sadder film. It's a lot more plangent as well as a soulful film, I think.
But it has to be. You have to move on from East is East. That's the whole thing about not repeating East is East. You have to move on and take the characters further on.
What it does do is examine the relationship of homeland and belonging.
But I think in the film it covers that really well because, you know, Sajid kind of learns that you have to leave behind the past. The past is the past. You can't take it into your future. And I think George realises that the life he's been living all this time in England is not the life. It's a Disneyland life. And the image he had of Pakistan is completely different to what it actually was.
It's a fascinating film, as I say. It's very complicated, I think, in terms of where it is. And I think it's beautiful for that. I think it's much more kind of plangent work and kind of soulful work.
It's a bigger emotional canvas than East is East was.
Well, congratulations on
it. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And West is West is released across the UK this Friday. Now, after locking himself in a darkened room with the collected works of Justin Bieber, an apparition comes blinking back into the light. It's none other than our very own Zan Brooks. Zan, you all right?
Yes, I'm not bad. I'm good. Converted.
Good, you're a believer, I believe.
I am, yes. That's what they say.
Good. We're going to talk about Animal Kingdom this week. We'll talk about The Right, which stars Anthony Hopkins. And we'll talk about Howl, starring Oscar host James Franco. Well, we had Animal Kingdom's director David Michaud on the podcast last week. So we'll start with him. An explosive crime drama set in present-day Melbourne.
You may think that you're one of the strong creatures, but you're not. You're one of the weak ones. But you've survived because you've been protected by the strong. But they're not strong anymore.
Guy Pearce as Detective Leckie, just one of a large ensemble cast in Animal Kingdom. The Cody family, who are kind of sucking the young Jay Cody into their web, which is kind of run by Jackie Weaver, one of the surprise Oscar nominees from this film, which had 18 Australian Film Institute nominations, a record. It ended up with 10 of them. Deserved?
I don't know what it was up against.
Well, never is up against much in Australia.
This is the kind of worry, isn't it? It's the in the land of the blind, you might say. But this is a first-rate film.
Isn't
and
it?
I can't believe that there would be anything to rival it over there this year.
No, there wasn't.
You know, it's great. It's you were using the spider metaphor, being sucked in the web. But it's almost like the family is a nest of scorpions, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I mean, there are many animal metaphors one could use,
yes,
I think.
Yes, we could go through the whole kingdom. Through the whole
flock
zoo.
Of seagulls.
Either way, it ain't good. You've got, is it James Freshfield playing Jay, who's a sort of 17-year-old, who lands on his grandma after his mum dies of a drug overdose. And the grandma, yes, is played by Jackie Weaver. And she, you know, she's that brilliant thing where she's got this sort of cuddly, matronly frame and this sort of benign, beaming smile and the eyes of a killer,
isn't she? It's an extraordinary
face. The coldest eyes in the world.
It really freaked me out. And it's a sort of role that grew as the film got bigger and bigger, and actually she comes to the fore near the end.
Well, this was it. I knew that she'd been Oscar-nominated, so then I'm watching it thinking, you know, she's good, but there's not much of her. And then, yeah, you're right, towards the final third, you realise that this is the power behind this family.
Yeah, the sort of matriarch, the lioness of the pack.
She's not simply just kind of running around after her ne'er-do-well sons. Mm. She's actually in total charge.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes this an interesting film, because there is this sort of Freudian subtext going on that is about crime. I mean, it doesn't really ever kind of get to grips with the causes of crime, much so I'm sure Tony Blair's dismay if he ever saw the film. But it makes you understand why they live this criminal life a bit, because there she is pulling the strings.
Yeah, I think so. And it also makes you understand how that life is now falling apart, and they're kind of getting embroiled with this sort of war with the Melbourne cops, really, that's all about pride and revenge, and yet it's completely destroying this family unit, this sort of battle that they're pursuing.
Yeah.
And they've got you've got a great performance from Guy Pearce as Detective Leckie.
Very nice. I
who's the sort of the angel on one shoulder of the kid, and the uncles are on the other shoulder.
It's like, I was thinking, it's a bit like Pacino and De Niro in Heat, where they kind of talk through that wall.
Yeah.
And here that wall is the kind of ingenue, the James Freshfield character. He's kind of in between them.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, Guy Pearce is... he has become such a good actor, and almost of this awards season, he's the great unsung hero. He was one of the best things in The King's Speech, and yet nobody's picking up on him at all. And here, it's a very unshowy performance. He's not really turning it on. He's just a cop doing his job.
Great tash.
Great tash as well, yeah.
That's all you need sometimes as an actor. Just you don't know what you're doing with the character. Give him a tash, it's like, I'm there, I've got him.
One of the other things this film does very well, it takes all the sort of the white trash elements of Australian culture, with the sort of slight Hawaiian shirts and the MOR music and the game shows always on TV and these cramped little suburban houses, and gives it this big operatic, kind of plays it as this big melodrama where it's just simmering on the boil all the time.
Yeah.
Possibly a little overcooked at times, but that's personal taste.
It's got a sort of heavy cloud over this film.
I mean, the
lead character, Ben Mendelssohn, who I think is really fine Australian.
Great.
Really
Uncle
good Australian.
Pope
Cody. He's a great Australian actor. I think better than Russell Crowe, although Crowe seems to be the one that sort of obviously kind of become the superstar. But Ben Mendelsohn, he looks a bit like Crowe. He looks a bit like the other guy, Noah Taylor, as well.
Yes.
He looks a bit like all of them, and yet he distills this character. I mean, it's just this kind of psychopathic, kind of mournful, depressed psychopath.
Yeah, exactly.
The worst
he's
kind.
He's not the kind of glamorous psychopath. Yeah. He's this sort of little schlub, basically. And he does this thing where he's always trying to get the family to confide in him. You know, just tell me. If you've got any problems, tell me. But really, he's just using it as a lever against them.
Yeah.
It's a great sense of the sort of family dynamic that's going on here. And it's totally gripping.
Amazing that it was a debut. I couldn't believe it was a debut. I really thought it was the work of a sort of, you know, someone who'd really kind of honed their skills doing TV or whatever. I'm very, very assured.
I was reading that he'd written sort of various drafts of this over many years. So obviously he had honed it and chucked out a lot of stuff. And it really has that, there's not a kind of an ounce of extra fat on this.
No, absolutely. A lean, mean Animal Kingdom, indeed. And I thought really one of the best crime dramas, certainly the best crime drama since A Prophet, I think.
I think so. And every now and again, Australia throws out these sort of films. I remember Lantana, probably about 10 years ago now, which had that same torpid, heavy, grey, sort of steely vibe to it.
Yeah,
and this
absolutely.
Has it too.
They do like their little crime families. I was talking to David Michaud about this last week. We the Kelly gang and the Proposition were sort of mad brothers, weren't they, led by Danny Houston. There's something about this in Australia. I've been to Australia. I've never been sucked into a web of crime, though.
I'm guessing you don't visit these kind of
families.
I've
never even had an affair with Shane Warne, which seems to happen to most people.
There's still time, Jason.
Okay, I shall get on Twitter immediately. And let's move on to our next film, which stars Anthony Hopkins as a murmuring, mumbling exorcist in a film called The Rite.
You know, the interesting thing about skeptics is that we're always looking for proof. The question is, what on earth would we do if we found it? What did you believe?
I believe that people prefer to lie to themselves than face the truth.
Last year, the Vatican received over 500,000 reports of demonic possession.
This was taken at an exorcism in Turin.
A Welsh exorcist, now, who'd have thought it?
Well, I think anyone would have thought it, really. If you're casting around for an actor to play this role, you know that Anthony Hopkins is right up there. And you know, more depressingly, that he'll do it.
He'll certainly do it.
If the price is right.
In the cupboard marked ham. Here he is. He's been up
hanging
there,
up.
Aged. Just right.
Cured.
Yeah, isn't he? He's of the finest vintage. A young man goes to the Vatican because he doesn't know whether he should be a priest or not, and he's persuaded. It's a really weird setup, isn't it? Because there's Toby Jones plays the seminary leader in America, and the young man sort of says, well, I don't think this priesthood's for me. And he says, there is an opening for a few exorcists. There's not a lot of exorcists around. Vatican are looking for exorcists. And he goes, that sounds all right.
I don't know how you can pick holes in this film, Jason, because it is, as we're reminded in the opening credits, inspired by a true story.
I think it's suggested.
No, it's suggested by a book and inspired by a story. Isn't that great?
Like reading the menu in a restaurant.
And prompted by
a lack of funds, I think. I mean, I don't mind an exorcism story. There's quite a lot of them around. Exorcism of Emily Rose. There was that one.
Yeah, The Exorcist.
Well, apart from The Exorcist, obviously the world's greatest film, obviously, according to critic of your and my knowledge. But there was one recently, a sort of a faux documentary kind of thing.
Oh, The Last Exorcism.
The Last Exorcism. There you go.
That was good, though.
Yeah, well, not bad. So there's a lot of it about. I don't know what that means.
I think it means we're all heading for the apocalypse.
Well, it doesn't. This film starts with a quote from John Paul II that sort of says the devil is alive and well.
I wish
and
more
in
films
Surbiton.
Started with a quote from John Paul II. Well, Social Network would have been so much better.
With a quote, even the current Pope would have been great to start a nice, or maybe the King's Speech.
Didn't
about
Big Mama's House start with a quote from John Paul II?
It certainly did. The one where he went,
but anyway,
I'm dying. Should we talk about The Rite at all?
Let's do that. Yeah, it's got, you know, it's got a plague of frogs in there.
It has
it's
a plague of frogs.
Guttering candles. It's got, any time anyone steps into a dark corridor, you hear a that you never know who's actually laughing.
It did remind me, because Hannibal was set in Rome. The second one. And this reminded me completely of that. It was just that I was wandering around in a robe.
It did. And it's him doing the Hannibal Lecter thing. You know, on the one hand, he's wise and good and very knowledgeable. And then he goes a little bit crazy towards the end.
There's quite a lot of people possessed by the devil.
There's
in this
a lot
going,
of that.
Yeah.
Well, there's condoms. A great line in there where Anthony Hopkins early on says, what did you expect? You know, it's nothing like you see on the movies. You don't get spinning heads and pea soup. And the next thing you know, there's spinning heads and someone's coughing up nails.
Yeah.
So you think, there's just the nails.
I see what you've done there. You're riffing on Friedkin.
It's total schlock.
It really is, though. I mean, but almost, it's pointless as well.
It's pointless.
It hasn't got anything to say about
schlock
God or the devil.
Schlock is fine, but this has this horrible, sort of heavy, stentorian pompous quality to it as well, that it, you sort of feel that they're trying to make some serious points about faith and God and yeah. things in there as well, and it just doesn't work.
But they haven't got any of those
points. And actually, I came to quite like Hopkins, particularly when he knocks over the little girl on the steps.
Gives her a right smack, doesn't
yeah, he? He does. I liked him because the main actor, Colin O'Donoghue, was so bland as the lead.
He was rubbish. He was clearly Irish as well. I know, he was supposed to be American, but he was clearly Irish.
I thought that he might have been exercised. Because there was sort of nothing there anymore.
I see
there was no
done
yeah.
Alice Braga, who I yep. like,
and always, I know, always well, wish I know was, you do. Well, in a special way.
I always wish she was in better films. Though they always get her to be in the kind of like blindness. They always get her to be the kind of quite
soulful,
pretty girl,
yeah.
soulful pretty girl
yeah.
in earnest movie that's
yeah.
not much good.
Yeah.
And God, she needs to do different
she
things
does.
Other
She's
than just kind
agent.
Of going, oh my God, oh my God. Which she does a lot in The Right. So I would say The Wrong, not The Right.
Oh, it's so wrong.
Dan, shall we finally move on to Howl?
Let's do Howl.
Yeah, Howl. H-O-W-L. It is the Allen Ginsberg poem from 1955, and it's a film about it, an experimental kind of film which combines courtroom drama, animation, James Franco reading out the poem as a beatnik in the Six Gallery in New York, and a little bit of kind of reconstruction of his life with Jack Kerouac and Neil Cassady. He is the Oscar host, and he is in Howl.
I started writing poetry because I fell in love, and I needed to express my feelings.
Howl. I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked.
Would you say that Howl,
the poem by Ginsberg, is obscene?
Yes.
Holy, holy, holy.
If it has any literary value, it's negligible.
Holy Kerouac, holy Cassady.
Who blew and were blown by those human seraphim.
You feel like you're going through the gutter when you read that stuff.
Now, you understand what blew and blown mean.
Angel-headed hipsters indeed, Zan. It's a strange piece of work, this.
How do you go about making a film about a poem, I guess? And this is a decent stab at it. It's basically, I guess it's kind of lit-crit cinema in a way, isn't it? It's non-linear, it's analytical, it uses little animated segments in there.
Quite a lot of animation.
Yeah, it flashes back and forth.
Did you like the animation?
Not really.
It's by Eric Drucker.
Well, you know, I'm sure the animation in and of itself is fine, but
well,
it
yeah,
felt
when he covers
like
it, doesn't go outside the lines. It's all technically all
yeah,
right.
Better than I could have done.
Yes.
I didn't get the call for this, but it just felt like a little bit of padding in a way. It felt like how can we kind of represent the poem on screen and let's have some animation.
Yeah,
you know, it's okay. I thought James Franco was very good as Ginsberg. Some of the other actors
not so much,
but that's not their fault.
Whose fault is it?
It's the scriptwriter's fault.
Oh, I see. Well,
I'm blaming
especially
the
courtroom drama with John
yeah,
Hamm. Every time John Hamm steps outside Mad Men, I think he embarrasses himself.
Well, I don't know if he even is stepping outside of Mad Men here. They're totally going for the Mad Men vibe.
He's got the suit
and he's got the kind of the same manner, and you know, he's basically the defense attorney defending the poem. David Strathairn is you know, for the prosecution, and it covers the whole obscenity trial. None of these characters get much room to move.
Well,
and it felt like a bit like living theatre.
It's taken from word for word from the transcripts of the court
yeah.
proceedings, and I always think that's a bit of a shame as an actor, because you're kind of hidebound by this kind of rather arid kind of stenographer,
yes,
really,
exactly.
Than a script writer. So those bits for me didn't work. And I didn't like the bit where Franco gives an interview to a sort of, I think it's a Time magazine journalist who you never see except their hand scribbling notes. And I thought that was a bit self-regarding, that stuff. That was just him kind of going, well, my God. And I thought that was a bit too much. But I did like the bits where he's reading out the poem in the club.
Oh, the poem is great. It does capture something about how electrifying this work was
yeah.
when it kind of landed on
Do you think it still
safe,
is?
Conservative middle America. Of course not. But that's because it's just been done over. It's been plagiarised so much.
Full of clichés.
Yeah.
Angel-headed hipsters, I ask you.
Exactly. So it's impossible. It's like, you know, reading Kerouac's On the Road, that you have a sort of afterglow of what it was, but now it's hard to sort of
I mean, I don't know when it was that you first read Howl and On the Road, probably when you were about 14 or 15.
Yeah, it would have been. But I remember quite recently reading a very good non-fiction book called This is the Beat Generation by James Campbell,
yeah.
which goes back over all of that and just brings it to life in three dimensions. And I'm not sure for all of the goodwill that's invested in this film and the obvious affection and knowledge, whether this was quite a three-dimensional film. It felt a little bit like a sort of playful, rough guide to how. And I could really imagine it being screened at sort of A-level English classes.
Yeah, and I would be,
and that would be fine.
A better lesson than listening to Mr. Andrews.
It would. Mr. Andrews, he's been fired now.
Oh, has he?
Yeah.
He used to teach Simon and Garfunkel as well.
There was another obscenity trial. Tied up with him.
Poor Mr. Andrews, hope he's listening. All right, Dave. Zan, that's Howl. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about No Strings Attached, because I think you should know these things before you sadly fall.
Should I?
It stars Natalie Portman, who's hot favourite to win the Oscar for
this
one. Yeah, no, not for this.
Right.
This is one of those films that comes out just before the Oscars. And do you remember there was Anne Hathaway was very much up for, in the running for Rachel Getting Married? And then she did a film called Bride Wars
with Kate Hudson.
A terrible film. Yeah, there you
that
go.
That was bad.
And you look at the shock in your eyes. It's like you've just kind of...
It's just reliving it.
Yeah, exactly.
I howled through that.
And lots of people said that scuppered her Oscar chances, so bad was the film. And do you remember Eddie Murphy? Everyone said he was going to get an Oscar for Dreamgirls, and he brought out Norbit. And everyone thought, oh God, that's so bad. You could scupper it. I think Natalie Portman might well have just done herself in with this, releasing
but
this.
But presumably
this
it's not Natalie Portman. It's some studio. Well, some studio going, right, we can cash in on this.
She thinks she's good in Black Swan. Look how shit she is in this.
Yeah.
God, it's awful. It's a romantic comedy with Ashton Kutcher in which they just try to have sex.
Yeah.
But she has, Natalie Portman, you know, the Black Swan thing, it's all about her trying to get in touch with her sort of sexy side. Having done that in Black Swan, she now wears a bra all the way through sex. A Black Swan would not wear a trainer bra all the way through sex.
No, not even the White Swan would do
no,
that.
No, I don't think so either. Ashton Kutcher is kind of affable in his own kind of like goofy kind of way.
Yeah.
His dad is played by Kevin Klein, who does a lot of taking his top off and playing the piano because he's an old TV star. They work in Hollywood on some kind of Glee type program. She's a nurse. This is a film that has no kind of narrative. It just does montages. This is the bit where they kind of go on their date around Los Angeles. Montage. This is the bit where they have sex. Montage. This is the bit where they break up. Sad little montage bit, teacher and doing sad things. This is the bit where Ashton gets drunk and kind of cold dials all his kind of ex-girlfriend, falls over in bushes. There's no actual kind of linear stuff. It's all a montage. And I have to say that I didn't like it very much at all. No strings attached. I think Natalie Portman has some strings attached because someone was working her. I don't know who. Anyway, she probably will win on Sunday night. I'm not sure that the Academy have had time to see No Strings Attached before they put their markers in. Zan, you'll be ready for Sunday night's Oscars?
I will be ready.
What are you wearing?
I think I'm just going to wear what I'm wearing right now.
Exactly the same.
Right through the week.
Right, excellent. Quite
it's an
right.
Oscar tradition. I shall be live blogging. I shall be probably expecting the King's Speech to win.
Yeah.
Hoping The Social Network, maybe.
Now, we've got to do our...
We've got to do that, haven't we? And
thing.
Actually, this year, last year, I was fairly confident about my predictions. This year, I really don't have much of a clue.
I haven't seen a couple of the short films as well, so that's going to scope me. I haven't seen a few of the
I'm not worried about those things. My God, I'm worried about the main ones.
The main ones.
The big ones.
Yeah.
I really don't know.
But what about foreign as well? There are a couple of foreigns I've not seen.
Yeah.
Some very good intuiting goes on in the foreign category. Maybe we'll do the same again. Let's reconvene Sunday night. We shall compare our forecast then, and I look forward to watching you frazzle yourself during a live blog.
Yeah, you always get a kick out of that.
I do. Zan Brooks, thanks very much for all of Zan's reviews, musings, live bloggings. Go to guardian.co.uk/film. The Oscar-nominated documentary Wasteland is the work of British director Lucy Walker, with whom I confess I used to share a house back at university. The film charts the collaboration between contemporary Brazilian artist Vic Muniz and the men and women who sift through the world's largest landfill site on the outskirts of Rio de Janeiro. The film shows the lives of the rubbish pickers, or catadores, and Vic Muniz's efforts to help them get recognition and better living conditions. The irony of Lucy Walker making a film about a rubbish tip is not lost on anyone who used to live with her and has ever seen her bedroom.
What I really want to do is to be able to change the lives of a group of people with the same material that they deal with every day.
Lot number 272, see great work by Vic Muniz, Pictures of Garbage.
And I'm delighted to say that Lucy Walker joins me on the line from Venice Beach this fine LA morning in the week on the run-up to her Oscar debut. Lucy, congratulations on your Oscar nomination. It must be very exciting.
It is a bit too exciting at times, but yes, it's brilliant.
Yeah, so I mean, what do you do in the run-up to Oscar week? I guess you're just kind of, you know, pressing the flesh. You're kind of, I know you did a documentary day where all your fellow nominees were screening as well. Does it put into perspective what it really means to get the Oscar nomination for a film like yours?
Yeah, it's really, I mean, especially this year because there's so many good docs, it was a real honour to be included. But the first thing that happened when I got the phone call was that I went back to sleep because I was sort of exhausted, because actually to get nominated involves quite a lot of hard work, especially with a film like Wasteland that is a bit of a word of mouth movie, it doesn't sound very must-see, an artist in a garbage dump or rubbish tip. You know, it doesn't sound that appealing. But people love it so much and have responded so wonderfully, but you sort of have to persuade them. You sort of have to pound the pavement and go to all the festivals and ask everyone to see it and sort of do a lot of press. I honestly, when I first got the call that we'd been nominated, I just went to sleep and I thought, I'm so tired, sort of job done. My first reaction was like, phew, you know, we got it this far. And then the second thing is you wake up and you don't have very long or any money to have an Oscar campaign, but you do have to have some screenings and you want Academy members to see it in order to vote. People have to see the movie, so you have to sort of fly around the place. At one point last week I did screenings and sort of cocktail receptions in New York, San Francisco, London, Los Angeles, and Berkeley, each on consecutive nights. And you're certainly not getting flown first class, that's for sure. So it was a little bit hair-raising. It's kind of a big, you know, fashion ordeal for a busy documentary filmmaker to suddenly stand on the red carpet when you want to look good, but actually you've got quite a lot of other things to do, like getting a visa. The star of our show is a guy named Tiao, who is fantastically cool, president of the Association of Garbage Workers. He's about 30, and I think he's like the President Obama, you know, in waiting.
He's the guy in your film who comes out like brilliantly from it. I mean, he's a character who emerges from the wreckage, the rubble, the rubbish, let's say, and yes, becomes this beautiful human being at the end of it. And you're kind of all cheering in your seat. You want this guy to completely succeed. So he's coming to the Oscars.
He's my date. And he doesn't speak English. He's been working in a rubbish dump since the age of 11. And this is a fairy tale. I mean, this is a fairy tale for everyone that's working, you know, for all the people who recycle by hand, which is 1% of the world's urban population, by the way, you know, and doing this fantastic, you know, environmental heroic job, but super ostracized. And it's a dirty job, from the world's biggest rubbish dump to the world's biggest red carpet. It's just a fairy tale.
Yeah, and some people will say that you won't be able to tell which is the trashier.
That'll be you saying that, Jason.
I mean, I think it's also a film that asks questions. It is a film that has these beautiful people in it and a great story, but it's a film that asks questions about the usefulness of things, the objects that we use for art, recyclable. And also, I think you wrote a piece in The Observer last weekend in the magazine, that in a way it's about recycling the spirituality of the people that are watching it, the audience. And that's obviously what people are responding to. And I did too as well. I was cheering in my seat as well, because even though the art project that your film chronicles by Vic Muniz is indeed noble and beautiful, your film takes us sort of deeper into it than that can possibly do. It's an interesting kind of parallel of art forms as well: photography, usefulness, commercialism, consumerism, materialism. All of that is bundled up.
Yay. No, I love that you see that. I do. I think it's really rich in food for thought. There's so much amazing stuff that happens. And this landfill is incredibly spectacular, cinematic location. But it's also exactly raises all these incredible questions about what we value and people that have been discarded and yet have sort of recycled themselves. And also you sort of see this art project from the very beginning. So you sort of see before your eyes the sort of transformative power of art actually unfold, which normally with documentaries, I suppose, you don't really get to document the whole process. So part of the fun is you see the artist at the beginning sort of scared, thinking that he's going to meet these murderers and mad people. And then he gets there and realizes that they're the coolest people ever. And then sort of the adventure sort of begins.
We really have to be really careful, because I really can see already how delicate the whole situation of having them there is for them, for their mind. Like, you know, they totally forgot about Gramacho. They don't want to go back.
In the beginning,
I had the impression, and I think now this is wrong, that they were happy there. And I think it has a lot to do with denial.
I think that's exactly where you reach the point to think, should you take them to London? I think it's quite, it's a super delicate question, because like that, if you're starting to change them already, just bringing them to the other studio, just involving them in a different lifestyle in Rio, what's going to happen to them once you put them in a plane?
There's a fantastic journey, because then the artist sort of reflects on his own material life. And when he gets back to his amazingly sumptuous artist's loft filled with all the art books and all the cameras and toys and stuff that he has. It looks like so much rubbish, and he looks a bit depressed and lonely, trapped by these possessions, whereas back in the landfill, you know, they're sort of gallivanting around, having a real laugh and creating this art piece together and feeling, you know, so connected and full of meaning. It's really, it's a wonderful thing about documentaries is sometimes you can really observe the things, and a situation like this, which is just so interesting, there's a lot for the audience to really sort of reflect on, which
exactly.
I really love.
I want to sort of mention that the documentaries this year are actually kind of very interesting in that they kind of put out what documentaries are about. You've got a kind of spoof documentary in the Banksy, you've got a kind of quite a classic documentary in The Inside Job, which is kind of a job of journalism, if you like, and then there's your film, which is very much about character, about story arc, about following people. It could be a fiction if you were writing a story about this landfill site. As you say, it's got a cinematic kind of backdrop, it's got character. They're very different approaches to documentary that are around, which suggests that it's actually the more interesting form than fiction sometimes.
I think it's a really interesting time to make non-fiction films. You've got these cheap cameras these days, also non-linear editing, which is particularly great for documentary film because you're sifting through piles of footage and trying to construct a really tight narrative. And in order to do that, these new editing systems are so efficient and brilliant to access stuff and try stuff out and really work material. Whereas in the old days, you're like, it was just, you know, you had to cut these things with little guillotines and basically sellotape them together. I mean, you know, there are fancier, you know, technical terms for that. But basically, you're dealing with miles and miles of celluloids sort of dangling in strips that you couldn't even see what it was. I mean, it was a nightmare editing in the old days. And for documentaries, when you didn't even have a script and scenes, it was super prohibitive. So now I think you've got this explosion of people playing with this form. And it's a really exciting time to be a documentary filmmaker. There's 2.5 of the Oscar-nominated docs are directed by Brit. So I'm really hoping that BAFTA will start to recognize documentary feature films in its awards this year as well, because I sort of feel like it's time for nonfiction filmmaking to have its place in cinema in Britain. I think in a way, actually, in the UK, that TV documentaries have historically been so strong that people have sort of thought of documentaries more in terms of great television, whereas I think in the States, in a funny way, the television documentary tradition was not so brilliantly funded or executed. It didn't have such a home.
Yeah, well, I think
TV.
It did have a home. I think so, it was quite ghettoized on like PBS and stuff. So Fred Wiseman, who did these amazing films, but no one really saw them, but they were funded. So I don't think they kind of broke out to get watched enough. But your film certainly has that, you know, I think
yeah.
It's great cinema. I really do. I think it's kind of
a
film.
Exactly. Well, I think in recent years in the States and now in the UK, I think people have really caught on to this idea that you can put non-fiction film on a big screen and a movie. And I trained as a fiction filmmaker, and I love fiction movies, and I sort of keep thinking it's an accident that I've made 4 documentaries now. It's really nice to use. You can use fantastic music, like Moby does the music for Wayfan, and it's just gorgeous. Or you can use fantastic cinematography. You can use fantastic editing. There's no need to be the poor cousin and sort of like just sort of shoddy looking. You can actually be brilliant, brilliant, use all the crafts of filmmaking, but apply them to a story involving real people, and then it's really moving.
What I also love about documentaries is that the story never finishes as well. I mean, yes, it's kind of current and there is a bit, your addenda to the story is that now Tiao, out of the rubbish, goes to the red carpet at the Oscars himself. You know, the story continues, which is brilliant with documentaries.
Exactly. Tiao, who's my date, said something lovely. He said he keeps thinking that the clock's going to tick to midnight and his shoes are going to vanish and things are going to go back exactly the way they were before. And then he remembers that everything has changed now because of the film.
Tell us where the money goes back to then.
It goes back to the people in the film and their association, and it's very important right now because the garbage dump is closing. It's reached capacity, and so it's very important that people there have skills training for new careers, because these are people who have chosen not to be sex workers or drug traffickers or to rob or beg. These are people who've, you know, when the going got really tough, they sort of turned environmental hero and are picking through, you know, our garbage, because in Brazil there's no separation of recyclables, so people are actually hand sifting through the garbage as the trucks dump it out in the landfill. Meantime, you know, these people are doing this incredibly dirty job quite brilliantly and quite efficiently, but sort of great risk to themselves and suffering quite a lot of prejudice and danger. and altogether really nice to sort of throw a spotlight on them because they're incredibly cool and charming. You can't believe how resourceful they are. These are people who pick the books out of the garbage and read them. There's Irma, who is this older woman, and she takes all the past the sell by date produce and she cooks them up in pots and pans that are salvaged from the rubbish using the hot jets of gas that come out, the methane gas, sort of like Bunsen burner fashion cooking. And she cooks this at sell-by produce and for all the workers and they eat it. And she says when she makes a particularly good stew, they all sing happy birthday even when it's not her birthday.
Did you eat it? And, I was wondering when I was watching, did you chow down?
I must confess that my appetite did evaporate a little bit in the landfill. I wasn't I wasn't eating a bunch when I was there. It's, you know, one thing that audiences in this film should be very glad about is that we did not present this film in smell-o-vision. It is a smelly place. And when you watch the movie, that the smell is not conveyed, I would say.
Well, I hope he wears some cologne on the red carpet, your date, Chow, on the evening, because I think it'll be... It's a brilliant, brilliant story, Lucy, and I love your enthusiasm for it. It is even bigger now that you've shot it. So keep that enthusiasm all the way up till Sunday night. Hopefully we can speak to you again to find out if you win that Oscar. But for now, the UK audiences will, I'm sure, enjoy Wasteland as much as I did. The documentaries are kind of addressing the real issues. When most people are talking about Stuttering King, I hope they come away from the Oscars instead talking about recycling and the usefulness of art. Lucy Walker, thanks very much for joining us on Film Weekly.
Thank you.
Wasteland is released here in the UK on Friday the 25th of February and of course will be seen at the Oscars on Sunday the 27th. We wish Lucy the best of luck from Film Weekly. That's all for this week. The music featured in the podcast is the score from the forthcoming film Norwegian Wood by Vietnamese director Tran Anh Hung. It features classic krautrock from Cannes and an original score by Johnny Greenwood. Yes, he fitted that in with making a Radiohead album. Amazing. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for my Trailer Trash column as ever and the best film news and reviews. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly this week, Ian Chambers, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.